I impetuously asked. "It is what you can see of your eyes without a mirror," was the answer. I was suddenly hungry, but had no desire to leave my room. Nonetheless, I went back down to the Chinese restaurant and pointed to a picture of what I wanted on the menu. I had shrimp balls and steamed cabbage dumplings wrapped in leaves in a bamboo basket. I drew a likeness of Desai on the napkin, exaggerating his unruly hair atop a face at once handsome and comic. It occurred to me that both writers shared this charming characteristic, hair that stood on end. I paid my check and got back into the elevator. My sector of the hotel seemed inexplicably empty. Sundown, dawn, full night, my body had no sense of time, and I decided to accept it and proceed Fred's way, following no hands. Within a week I would be in the time zone of Ace and Dice, but these days were entirely my own, with no design other than the hope of filling a few pages with something of worth. I crawled under the covers to read but passed out in the middle of Hell Screen and missed the balance of the afternoon and sunset transitioning into evening. When I awoke, it was too late to dine, so I grabbed some snacks from the minibar, a bag of fish-shaped crackers dusted with wasabi powder, an oversized Snickers bar, and a jar of blanched almonds. Dinner downed with ginger ale. I laid out some clothes and showered, then decided to go out, if only to walk around the parking lot. Covering my damp hair with a watch cap, I went out and followed the path the young girls had taken. There were steps carved into a small hill that seemed to lead nowhere. Unconsciously, I had already developed some semblance of routine. I read, sat before the metal desk, ate Chinese food, and retraced my own footsteps in the night snow. I attempted to quell any recurring agitation with a repetitive exercise, writing the name Osamu Desai over and over, nearly 100 times. Unfortunately, the page spilling out the name of the writer amounted to nothing. My regimen slipped into a pointless web of haphazard calligraphy. Yet somehow, I was drawing closer to my subject. Desai, the dazed one, a stumblebum, an aristocratic tramp. I could see the spikes of his unruly hair and feel the energy of his accursed remorse. I got up, boiled a pot of water, drank some powdered tea, and stepped into a cloud of well-being. Closing my journal, I placed several sheets of hotel stationery before me. Taking long, slow breaths, I emptied myself and began again. The young leaves did not fall from the trees, but clung desperately throughout winter. Even as the wind whistled, to the astonishment of everyone, they had the audacity to remain green. The writer was unmoved. The elders regarded him with disgust. To them he was a wobbling poet on the brink. In turn, he regarded them with contempt, imagining himself an elegant surfer riding the crest, never crashing. "The ruling class," he shouts, "the ruling class." He wakes in pools of sweat, his shirt stiff with salt. The tuberculosis he has carried since youth has calcified his tiny seeds, minute black sesame liberally seasoning his lung. A bout of drink sets him off. Strange women, strange beds, a hard cough spraying kaleidoscopic stains across foreign sheets. "I could not help it," he cries. "The well begs for the lips of the drunkard. Drink me, drink me," it calls. Insistent bells are tolling, a litany of he. His sinewy arms tremble beneath billowing sleeves. He bends over his low table, composing small suicide notes that somehow become something else entirely. Slowing his blood, the beating of his heart, With the forbearance of a fasting scribe, he writes what has to be written. Conscious of the movement of his wrists as words spread across the surface of the paper like an ancient magic spell. He savors his one joy, a cold pint of muruku that moves through a system like a transfusion of milky corpuscles. The sudden brightness of dawn startles him. He staggers into the garden. Bright blooms stick out their fiery tongues. Sinister oleanders of the Red Queen. When did the flowers become so sinister? He tries to remember when it all went wrong, how the threads of his life unraveled like winding linen from the unbound feet of a fallen consort. He is overcome with the disease of love, the drunkenness of generations past. When are we ourselves, he wonders, trudging through the snow-covered banks, his coat illuminated by moonlight, long pelts, lined heavy silk the color of aged parchment, with the words, eat or die, written in his own distinct hand on the sleeve, vertically on the back and beneath the collar running down his left side over his heart. Eat or die, eat or die, eat or die. I paused, wishing I could hold such a coat in my hands, and realized the hotel phone was ringing. It was Dice calling on behalf of Ace. The phone rang many times. Have we disturbed you? No, I'm happy to hear from you. I've been writing something for Asamu Desai, I said. Then you will be happy with our itinerary. I am ready. What first? Ace has booked dinner at Mifune. Then we can plan for tomorrow. I will meet you in the lobby in 1 hour. I was delighted by the choice of Mifune, a sentimental favorite themed on the life of the great Japanese actor Toshiro Mifune. Most likely much sake would be consumed, and perhaps a special soba dish prepared for me. My solitude could not have been severed in a more fortuitous way. I quickly straightened my things, slipped an aspirin into my pocket, and reunited with Ace and Dice. Just as I supposed, the sake flowed. Drenched in the atmosphere of a Kurosawa film, we immediately picked up the thread of a year ago. Graves, temples, and forests in the snow. The next morning they picked me up in Ace's two-tone Fiat, resembling a red and white saddle shoe. We drove around looking for coffee. I was so happy to finally have some that Ace had them fill a small thermos for later.
Didn't you know, asked Dice, that in the renovated annex of the Okura they serve a full American breakfast? Oh, no, I laughed. I bet I missed out on vats of coffee.
Ace is the one person I would accept an itinerary from, as his choices consistently correspond with my own desires. We drove to the Kotoku Inn, a Buddhist temple in Kamakura, and paid our respects to the great Buddha that loomed above us like the Eiffel Tower. So mystically intimidating that I only took one shot. When I impaled the image, it revealed that the emulsion was faulty and had not captured his head. Perhaps he is hiding his face, said Dice. On the first day of our pilgrimage, I barely used my camera. We laid flowers by the public marker for Akira Kurosawa. I thought of his great body of work from Drunken Angel to his masterpiece Ran, an epic that might have caused Shakespeare to shudder. I remembered experiencing Ran in a local theater in the outskirts of Detroit. Fred took me for my 40th birthday. The sun had not yet set, and the sky was bright and clear. But in the course of the 3-hour film, unbeknownst to us, a blizzard struck, and as we exited the theater, a black sky whitewashed by a vortex of snow awaited us. We are still in the film, he said. Ace consulted a printed map of Ngankoji Cemetery. As we passed the train station, I stopped to watch the people as they patiently waited, then crossed over the railway line. An old express rattled past, as if the clattering hooves of past scenes galloped from brutal angles. Shivering, we searched for the grave of the filmmaker Ozu, a difficult undertaking, for it was isolated in a small enclave on higher ground. Several bottles of sake were placed before his headstone, a black granite cube containing only the character Mu, signifying nothingness. Here a happy tramp could find shelter and drink himself into oblivion. Ozu loved his sake, said Ace. No one would dare to open his bottles. Snow covered everything. We mounted the stone steps and placed some incense and watched the smoke pour, then hover perfectly still, as if anticipating how it might feel to be frozen. Scenes of films flickered through the atmosphere. The actress, Setsuko Hara, lying in the sun, her open, clear expression and her radiant smile. She had worked with both masters, first with Kurosawa and then six films with Ozu. Where is she resting? I asked, thinking to bring an armful of huge white chrysanthemums and lay them before her marker. She is still alive, Dice translated, 92 years old. May she live to be 100, I said, faithful to herself. The next morning was overcast, the shadows oppressive. I swept the grave of Desai and washed the headstone as if it were his body. After rinsing the flower holders, I placed a fresh bunch in each one, a red orchid to symbolize the blood of his tuberculosis, and small branches of white forsythia. Their fruit contained many wing seeds. The forsythia gave off a faint almond scent. The tiny flowers that produce milk sugar represented the white milk that gave him pleasure through the worst of his debilitating consumption. I added bits of baby's breath, a cloud panicle of tiny white flowers, to refresh his tainted lungs. The flowers formed a small bridge, like hands touching. I picked up a few loose stones and slipped them into my pocket. Then I placed the incense in the circular holder, laying it flat. The sweet-smelling smoke enveloped his name. We were about to leave when the sun suddenly erupted, brightening everything. Perhaps the baby's breath had found its mark, and with refreshed lung, Desai had blown away the clouds that had blocked the sun. I think he's happy, I said. Ace and Dice nodded in agreement. Our final destination was the cemetery at Jingenji. As we approached the grave of Akutagawa, I recalled my dream and wondered how it would color my emotions. The dead regard us with curiosity. Ash, bits of bone, a handful of sand, the quiescence of organic material, waiting. We lay our flowers, yet cannot sleep. We are wooed, then mocked, plagued like Amfortas, king of the Grail Knights, by a wound refusing to heal. It was very cold, and once again the sky grew dark. I felt strangely detached, numb, yet visually connected. Drawn to contrasting shadows, I took four photographs of the incense burner. Though they were all similar, I was pleased with them, envisioning them as panels on a dressing screen. Four panels, one season. I bowed and thanked Akutagawa as Ace and Dice hurried to the car. As I followed after them, the capricious sun returned. I passed an ancient cherry tree bound in frayed burlap. The cold light deepened the texture of the binding, and I framed my last shot, a comic mask whose ghostly tears seemed to streak the burlap's worn threads. The following evening, I mentally prepared to change hotels, already mourning my secluded, repetitive routine. I had been encased in Hotel Akora's cocoon with two miserable moths,
not wishing to emerge, though not hiding their faces. Sitting at the metal desk, I wrote a list of my coming duties, including meetings with my publisher and translator. Then I would meet with Yuki and assist her with her continuing efforts on behalf of schoolchildren orphaned by the after effects of the 2011 Tohoku earthquake and tsunami. I packed my small suitcase in a haze of nostalgia for the present stream I was just about to divert. A handful of days in a world of my own making, fragile as a temple constructed with wooden matchsticks. I went into the closet and removed a futon mat and buckwheat pillow. I unrolled the mat on the floor and wrapped my comforter around me. I was watching what appeared to be the end of a kind of soap opera set in the 18th century. It was slow-moving without subtitles or an ounce of happiness. Yet I was content. The comforter was like a cloud. I drifted, transient, following the brush of a maiden as she painted a scene of such sadness on the sails of a small wooden boat that she herself wept. Her robe made a swishing sound as she wandered barefoot from room to room. She exited through sliding panels that opened onto a snow-covered bank. There was no ice on the river, and the boat sailed on without her. "Do not cast your boat on a river of tears," cried the tearing wind. "Small hands are still. Be still." She knelt and lay on her side, clutching a key, accepting the kindness of endless sleep. The sleeve of her robe was adorned with the outlines of a lucent branch of delicate plum blossoms whose dark centers were a spattering of minuscule droplets. I closed my eyes as if to join the maiden as the droplets rearranged themselves, forming a pattern resembling an elongated island on the rim of an undisturbed blankness. In the morning, Ace drove me to a more central hotel chosen by my publisher, near the Shibuya train station. I had a room in a modern tower on the 18th floor with a view of Mount Fuji. The hotel had a small cafe that served coffee in porcelain cups, all the coffee I wanted. The day was filled with duties, the lively atmosphere, an unexpectedly welcome change. Late that night, I sat before the window and looked at the great white-cloaked mountain that seemed to be watching over sleeping Japan. In the morning, I took the bullet train at Tokyo Station to Sendai, where Yuki was waiting. Behind her smile, I could see so many other things, a catastrophic sadness. I had assisted her from afar, and now we would turn over the fruits of new efforts to the selfless guardians of the unfortunate children who suffered infinite loss, their family, their homes, and nature as they had known and trusted. Yuki spent time talking with the children's teachers. Before we left, they presented us with a precious gift of a senbizuru, 1,000 paper cranes held together by string. Many small fingers worked diligently to present us with the ultimate sign of good health and good wishes. Afterwards, we visited the once bustling fisherman's port of Yuraji. The powerful tsunami, over 100 feet high, had swept away nearly 1,000 homes and all but a few battered ships. The rice fields, now unyielding, were covered with close to 1,000,000 fish carcasses, a rotting stench that hung in the air for months. It was bitter cold, and Yuki and I stood without words. I was prepared to see terrible damage, but not for what I didn't see. There was a small Buddha in the snow near the water, and a lone shrine overlooking what had once been a thriving community. We walked up the steps leading to the shrine, a humble slate monolith. It was so cold we could barely pray. "Will you take a picture?" she said. I looked down at the bleak panorama and shook my head. How could I take a picture of nothing? Yuki gave me a package, and we said our farewells.
I boarded the bullet train back to Tokyo. When I reached the station, I found Ace and Dice waiting for me. I thought we said goodbye. We could not abandon you. Shall we go back to Mifune's? Yes, let's go. The sake is surely waiting. Ace nodded and smiled. Time for sake. Our last evening was drenched in it. What a nice cup and tukori, I noted. They were cerulean green with a small red stamp. That is the official sign of Kurosawa, said Dice. Ace pulled on his beard, deep in thought. I roamed about the restaurant, admiring Kurosawa's bold and colorful renderings of the warriors of Ran. As we happily made our way back to the car, he produced the Tukorian cup from his worn leather sack. Friendship makes thieves of us all, I said. Dice was going to translate, but Ace stopped him with his hand. I understand, he said solemnly. I will miss you both, I said. That night, I set the cup and tukori on the table next to the bed. It still contained drops of sake that I did not rinse out. I awoke with a mild hangover. I got a cold shower and made my way through a labyrinth of escalators that led me nowhere. What I really wanted was coffee. I searched and found an express coffee shop, 900 yen for coffee and miniature croissants. Sitting at the next table facing mine was a man in his 30s dressed in a suit, white shirt and tie, working on his laptop. I noted a subtle stripe in his suit that was understated yet defiantly different. He had a demeanor above the average businessman's. He proceeded to change laptops, poured himself a coffee, then continued his work. I was touched by the serene yet complex concentration he manifested, the furrows of light on his smooth brow. He was handsome in a certain way, like a young Mishima, hinting at decorum, silent infidelities, and moral devotion. I watched the people passing. Time, too, was passing. I had thought to take a train to Kyoto for the day, but preferred drinking coffee across from the quiet stranger. In the end, I did not go to Kyoto. I took one last walk, wondering what would happen if I bumped into Murakami on the street. But in truth, I didn't feel Murakami at all in Tokyo, and I hadn't looked for the Miyawaki place, though its district was only a few miles away. So possessed with the dead, I had skipped contact with the fictional. Murakami is not here anyway, I thought. He is most likely somewhere else, sealed in a space capsule in the center of a field of lavender, laboring over words. That night I dined alone, an elegant meal of steaming abalone, green tea soba noodles, and warm tea. I opened a gift from Yuki. It was a coral-colored box wrapped in heavy paper, the color of sea foam. Inside the pale tissue were loops of soba from the Nagano Prefecture. They lay in the oblong box like several strings of pearls. Lastly, I focused on my pictures. I spread them across the bed. Most of them went into a souvenir pile, but those of the incense burner at the grave of Akutagawa had merit. I would not go home empty-handed. I got up for a moment and stood by the window, looking down at the lights of Shibuya and across to Mount Fuji. Then I opened a small jar of sake. I salute you, Akutagawa. I salute you, Dasai, I said, draining my cup. Don't waste your time on us, they seemed to say. We are only bums. I refilled the small cup and drank. All writers are bums, I murmured. May I be counted among you one day. Tempest Air Demons. I traveled home backwards through Los Angeles, stopping for a few days at Venice Beach, which is close to the airport.
I sat on the rocks and stared at the sea, listening to crisscrossing music, discordant reggae with its revolutionary sense of harmonics drifting from various boomboxes.
I ate fish tacos and drank coffee at the Café Collage, a block west from the Venice boardwalk.
I never bothered to change my clothes. I rolled up my pant legs and walked in the water. It was cold, but the salt felt good on my skin. I couldn't bring myself to open my suitcase or computer. I lived out of a black cotton sack. I slept to the sound of the waves and spent a lot of time reading discarded newspapers. After a last coffee at the Collage, I headed for the airport, where I discovered my bags had been left at the hotel. I boarded the plane with nothing but my passport, white pen, toothbrush, a traveler tube of Walita salt toothpaste, and a mid-size moleskin. I had no books to read, and there was no in-flight entertainment for the 5-hour flight. I immediately felt trapped. I flipped through the airline magazine featuring the top 10 skiing resorts in the country, then occupied myself with circling the names of all the places I had been on the double-spread map of Europe and Scandinavia. There were about 1,300 yen and 4 photographs inside the inner flap of the moleskin. I laid the pictures out on the tray table, an image of my daughter Jessie in front of Café Hugo in Place de Vosges, 2 outtakes of the incense burner at the grave of Akutagawa, and 1 of the poet Sylvia Plath's headstone in the snow. I tried to write something of Jessie but couldn't, as her face echoed her father's in the proud palace where the ghosts of our old life dwell. I slipped 3 of the pictures back into the pocket and focused on Sylvia in the snow. It was not a good picture, the result of a kind of winter penitence. I decided to write of Sylvia. I wrote to give myself something to read. It occurred to me that I was on a run of suicides. Akutagawa, Desai, Plath, death by water, barbiturates, and carbon monoxide poisoning. 3 fingers of oblivion, outplaying everything. Sylvia Plath took her life in the kitchen of her London flat on February 11, 1963. She was 30 years old. It was one of the coldest winters on record in England. It had been snowing since Boxing Day, and the snow was piled high in the gutters. The River Thames was frozen, and the sheep were starving on the fells. Her husband, the poet Ted Hughes, had left her. Their small children were safely tucked in their beds. Sylvia placed her head in the oven. One can only shudder at the existence of such overriding desolation. The timer ticking down. A few moments left, still a possibility to live, to turn off the gas. I wondered what passed through her mind in those moments. Her children, the embryo of a poem, her philandering husband buttering toast with another woman. I wondered what happened to the oven. Perhaps the next tenant got an impeccably clean range, a massive reliquary for a poet's last reflection, and a strand of light brown hair caught on a metal hinge. The plane seemed insufferably hot, yet other passengers were asking for blankets. I felt the inklings of a dull but oppressive headache. I closed my eyes and searched for a stored image of my copy of Ariel, given to me when I was 20. Ariel became the book of my life then, drawing me to a poet with hair worthy of a Breck commercial and the incisive observational powers of a female surgeon cutting out her own heart.
With little effort, I visualized my Ariel perfectly, slim, with faded black cloth, that I opened in my mind, noting my youthful signature on the cream endpaper.
I turned the pages, revisiting the shape of each poem. As I fixed on the first lines, impish forces projected multiple images of a white envelope, flickering at the corners of my eyes, thwarting my efforts to read them. This agitating visitation produced a pang,
for I knew the envelope well. It had once held a handful of images I had taken of the grave of the poet in the autumnal light of northern Britain. I had traveled from London to Leeds through Bronte country to Hebden Bridge to the ancient Yorkshire village of Heptonstall to take them. I brought no flowers. I was singularly driven to get my shot. I had only one pack of Polaroid film with me, but I had no need of more. The light was exquisite, and I shot with absolute assurance, 7 to be exact. All were good, but 5 were perfect. I was so pleased that I asked a lone visitor, an affable Irishman, to take my picture in the grass beside her grave. I looked old in the photograph, but it contained the same scintillating light, so I was content. In truth, I felt an elation I hadn't experienced in quite a while, that of easily accomplishing a challenging goal. Yet I offered a mere preoccupied prayer and did not leave my pen in a bucket by her headstone, as countless others had. I only had my favorite pen, a small white Mont Blanc, and did not want to part with it. I somehow felt exempt from this ritual, a contrariness I thought she would understand, but that I would regret. On the long drive to the train station, I looked at the photographs, then slipped them into an envelope. In the hours to come, I looked at them several times. Then some days later in my travels, the envelope and its contents disappeared. Heartsick, I went over my every move but never found them. They simply vanished. I mourned the loss, magnified by the memory of the joy I'd felt in the taking of them in a strangely joyless time. In early February, I again found myself in London. I took a train to Leeds, where I had arranged for a driver to take me back to Heptonstall. This time I brought a lot of film and had cleaned my 250 Land camera and painstakingly straightened the interior of the semi-collapsed bellows. We drove up a winding hill, and the driver parked in front of the moody ruins of St. Thomas A. Becket Churchyard. I walked to the west of the ruins to an adjacent field across Back Lane and quickly found her grave. "I have come back, Sylvia," I whispered, as if she had been waiting. I hadn't factored in all the snow. It reflected the chalk sky already infused with murky smears. It would prove difficult for my simple camera. Too much, then too little available light. After half an hour, my fingers were getting frostbitten and the wind was coming up. Yet I stubbornly kept taking pictures. I hoped the sun would return and I irrationally shot, using all of my film. None of the pictures were good. I was numb with cold but couldn't bear to leave. It was such a desolate place in winter, so lonely. Why had her husband buried her here, I wondered. Why not New England by the sea where she was born, where salt winds could spiral over the name Plath, etched in native stone? I had the uncontrollable urge to urinate and imagine spilling a small stream, some part of me wanting her to feel that proximate human warmth. Life, Sylvia, life. The bucket of pens was gone, perhaps retired for winter. I went through my pockets, extracting a small spiral notebook, a purple ribbon, and a cotton lisselle sock with a bee embroidered near the top. I tied the ribbon around them and tucked them by her headstone. The last of the light faded as I trudged back to the heavy gate. It was only as I approached the car that the sun appeared, and now with a vengeance. I turned just as a voice whispered, "Don't look back. Don't look back." It was as if Lot's wife, a pillar of salt, had toppled on the snow-covered ground and spread a lengthening heat, melting all in its path. The warmth drew life, drawing out tufts of green and a slow procession of souls. Sylvia, in a cream-colored sweater and straight skirt, shading her eyes from the mischievous sun,
walking on into the great return. In early spring, I visited Sylvia Plath's grave for a third time with my sister Linda. She longed to journey through Bronte country, and so we did together. We traced the steps of the Bronte sisters and then traveled up the hill to trace mine. Linda delighted in the overgrown fields, the wildflowers, and the Gothic ruins. I sat quietly by the grave, conscious of a rare suspended peace. Spanish pilgrims travel on Camino del Santiago from monastery to monastery, collecting small medals to attach to their rosary as proof of their steps. I have stacks of Polaroids, each marking my own, that I sometimes spread out like tarots or baseball cards of an imagined celestial team. There is now one of Sylvie in spring. It is very nice, but lacking the shimmering quality of the lost ones. Nothing can be truly replicated. Not a love, not a jewel, not a single line. I awoke to the sound of church bells ringing from the tower of Our Lady of Pompeii. It was 8 a.m. At last, some semblances of synchronicity. I was weary of having my morning coffee at night. Coming home through Los Angeles had twisted some inner mechanism. Like an errant cuckoo clock, I was operating on time interrupted by itself. My reentry had spun out strangely. Victim of my own comedy of errors, my suitcase and computer stranded in Venice Beach, and then, despite the fact that I had only a black cotton sack to be mindful of, I left my notebook on the plane. Once home, in disbelief, I dumped the meager contents of my sack onto my bed, examining them over and over as if the notebook would appear in the negative recesses between the other items. Cairo sat on the empty sack. I looked helplessly around my room. I have enough stuff, I told myself. Days later, an unmarked brown envelope appeared at my mail drop. I could see the outline of the black moleskin. Grateful but perplexed, I finally opened it. There was no note, no one to thank but the demon air. I extracted the photograph of Sylvia in the snow and examined it carefully. My penance for barely being present in the world. Not the world between the pages of books or the layered atmosphere of my own mind, but the world that is real to others. I then slipped it between the pages of Ariel. I sat reading the title poem, pausing at the lines, "And I am the arrow," a mantra that once emboldened a rather awkward but determined young girl. I had almost forgotten. Robert Lowell tells us in the introduction that Ariel does not refer to the chameleon-like sprite in Shakespeare's Tempest, but to her favorite horse. But perhaps the horse was named after the Tempest spirit. Ariel, angel, altars, lion of God. All are good, but it is the horse that flies over the finish line with Sylvia's arms wrapped around his neck. There was also a fair copy of a poem called New Foal that I placed in the book some time ago. It describes the birth and arrival of a foal, reminiscent of Superman as a babe, encrusted in a dark pod and hurled into space toward Earth. The foal lands, teeters, is smoothed by God and man to become horse. The poet who wrote it is one with the dust, but the new foal he created is lively, continually born and reborn. I was glad to be home, sleeping in my own bed, with my little television and all my books. I had only been gone a few weeks, but it somehow felt stretched into months. It was about time I salvaged a bit of my routine. It was too early to go to Eno, so I read. Rather, I looked at the pictures in Nabokov's butterflies and read all the captions. Then I washed, put on clean versions of what I was already wearing, grabbed my notebook, and hurried downstairs, the cats trailing after me, finally recognizing my habits as their own. March winds, both feet on the ground, the spell of jet lag broken. I was looking forward to sitting at my corner table and receiving my black coffee, brown toast, and olive oil without asking for it. There were twice as many pigeons than usual on Bedford Street, and a few daffodils had come up early. It didn't register at first, but then I realized that the blood-orange awning with Eno across it was missing. The door was locked, but I saw Jason inside and I tapped on the window. "I'm glad you came by," he said. "Let me make you one last coffee." I was too stunned to speak. He was closing up shop and that was it. I looked at my corner. I saw myself sitting there on countless mornings through countless years. "Can I sit down?" I asked. "Sure, go ahead." I sat there all morning.
A young girl who frequented the cafe was going by carrying a Polaroid camera identical to my own. I waved and went out to greet her.
"Hello, Claire, do you have a moment?"
"Of course," she said.
I asked her to take my picture, the first and last picture at my corner table in Eno. She was sad for me, having seen me through the window many times in passing. She took a few shots and laid one on the table, the picture of Woebegone. I thanked her as she left.
I sat there for a long time thinking of nothing, and then picked up my white pen. I wrote of the well and the face of Jean Reynaud. I wrote of the cowpoke and the crooked smile of my husband.
I wrote of the bats of Austin, Texas, and the silver chairs in the interrogation room in criminal intent. I wrote till I was spent, the last words written in Cafe Eno. Before we parted, Jason and I stood and looked around the small cafe together. I didn't ask him why he was closing. I figured he had his reasons, and the answer wouldn't make any difference anyway. I said goodbye to my corner. "What will happen to the tables and chairs?" I asked.
"You mean your table and chair?"
"Yeah, mostly." "They're yours," he said. "I'll bring them over later."
That evening, Jason carried them from Bedford Street across Sixth Avenue, the same route I had taken for over a decade. My table and chair from the Cafe Eno, my portal to where.
I climbed the 14 steps to my bedroom, turned off the light, and lay there awake. I was thinking about how New York City at night is like a stage set. I was thinking of how on a plane home from London, I watched a pilot for a TV show I'd never heard of called Person of Interest, and how two nights later there was a film crew on my street, and they asked me not to pass while they were shooting, and I spotted the main guy in Person of Interest being shot for a scene beneath the scaffolding about 15 feet from the right of my door.
I was thinking about how much I love this city.
I found the channel changer and watched the end of an episode of Doctor Who, the David Tennant configuration, the only Doctor Who for me. "One may tolerate the demons for the sake of an angel," Madame Pompadour tells him before he transports into another dimension. I was thinking what a beautiful match they would have made. I was thinking of French time-traveling children with Scottish accents breaking the hearts of the future.
Simultaneously, a blood-orange awning turned in my mind like a small twister. I wondered if it was possible to devise a new kind of thinking.
It was nearly dawn before I sank into sleep. I had another dream about the cafe in the desert. This time the cowpoke was standing at the door, gazing at the open plain. He reached over and lightly gripped my arm. I noticed that there was a crescent moon tattooed in the space between his thumb and forefinger, a writer's hand. How is it that we stray away from one another, then always come back? Do we really come back to one another, I answered, or just come here and lazily collide? He didn't answer. There's nothing lonelier than the land, he said. Why lonely? Because it's so damn free. And then he was gone. I walked over and stood where he had been standing and felt the warmth of his presence. The wind was picking up and unidentifiable bits of debris were circling in the air. Something was coming. I could feel it. I stumbled out of bed fully clothed. I was still thinking. Half asleep, I slipped on my boots and dragged a carved Spanish chest from the back of the closet. It had the patina of a worn saddle, with a number of drawers filled with objects, some sacred and some whose origins were entirely forgotten. I found what I was looking for, a snapshot of an English greyhound with Specter, 1971, written on the back. It was between the pages of a worn copy of Hawk Moon by Sam Shepard, with his inscription, "If you've forgotten hunger, you're crazy." I went to the bathroom to wash. A slightly waterlogged copy of No Longer Human was on the floor beneath the sink. I rinsed off my face, grabbed my notebook, and headed for Cafe Eno. Halfway across 6th Avenue, I remembered. I began to spend more time at the Dante, but at irregular hours. In the mornings, I just got deli coffee and sat on my stoop. I reflected on how my mornings at Cafe Eno had not only prolonged but also afforded my malaise with a small amount of grandeur. "Thank you," I said. "I have lived in my own book, one I never planned to write, recording time backwards and forwards. I have watched the snow fall into the sea and traced the steps of a traveler long gone. I have relived moments that were perfect in their certainty. Fred buttoning the khaki shirt he wore for his flying lessons. Doves returning to nest on our balcony. Our daughter Jessie standing before me, stretching out her arms. Oh, Mama, sometimes I feel like a new tree. We want things we cannot have. We seek to reclaim a certain moment, sound, sensation. I want to hear my mother's voice. I want to see my children as children, hands small, feet swift. Everything changes. Boy grown, father dead, daughter taller than me, weeping from a bad dream. Please stay forever, I say to things I know. Don't go. Don't grow. A Dream of Alfred Wegener. Another restless night. I got up at dawn and worked. My eyes burned from deciphering scribbled envelopes, end papers, and stained napkins, then transcribing the text of the computer with everything out of order, then trying to make sense of a subjective narrative with an asymmetrical timeline. I left the lot of it on my bed and went to Cafe Dante. I let my coffee run cold and thought about detectives. Partners depend on one another's eyes. The one says, "Tell me what you see." His partner must speak assuredly, not leaving anything out. But a writer has no partner. He has to step back and ask himself, "Tell me what you see." But since he is telling himself, he doesn't have to be perfectly clear, because something inside holds any given missing part, the unclear, or partially articulated. I wondered if I would have been a good detective. It kills me to say it, but I don't think so. I'm not the observant type. My eyes seemed to roll within. I paid the check, marveling that the same murals of Dante and Beatrice have papered the cafe walls since at least my first visit in 1963. Then I left and went shopping. I bought a copy of a new translation of the Divine Comedy in laces for my boots. I noticed I felt optimistic. I went to my mail drop and picked up the mail. A first edition of Anna Kavan's A Scarcity of Love, two royalty checks, a massive catalog from Restoration Hardware, and an urgent missive from our CDC secretary. It was absent the customary seal, so I opened it quickly with some trepidation. It contained a single watermark sheet advising all members that the Continental Drift Club was formally disbanding. She suggested that we shred any official correspondence with the CDC letterhead or seal and wished us all good health and contentedness.
At the bottom she had written, "Hope to meet again in pencil." I immediately wrote her a brief note promising I would do as she asked, adding some verses I had written for the CDC theme song. As I addressed the envelope, I could hear the plaintive sound of Number 7's accordion. "Saints stay in the snow. Where did Wegener go? Only Rasmus knows, and he is in God's hands. Raise an iron cross. He's no longer lost, found within our notes, and they are in God's hands."
I removed a gray archival box from the top shelf of my closet and spread the contents on the bed, a dossier containing our objectives, printed reading lists, my official confirmation, and red card, number 23. There was also a stack of notated napkins, a Polaroid of the chess table used by Bobby Fischer and Boris Spatsky, and my sketch of Fritz Lowe for the 2010 newsletter. I did not open the packet of official letters tied with blue string, but instead built a small fire and watched them burn. I sighed and crumpled the paper napkins containing the notes for my somewhat ill-fated talk. My intention had been to channel the last moments in the life of Alfred Wegener, drawing from the member's unified mind, prodded by the query, "What did he see?" But the light chaos I had inadvertently ignited obstructed any possibility of realizing a vision akin to poetry. "He departed from Eismitte on All Saints' Day, seeking provisions for his friends waiting anxiously for his return. It was his 50th birthday. The white horizon beckoned. He detected an arc of color staining the snow, one soul breaking apart from another. He called out to his love, a drifting continent away. Dropping to his knees, he could see his guide, several yards before him, raising his arms." I tossed the crumbled napkins into the flame, and each closed like a fist, slowly reopening like petals of small cabbage roses. Fascinated, I watched as they fused and formed one enormous rose. It ascended and hovered above the tent of the sleeping scientist. Its great thorns pierced the canvas, and its heavy fragrance rushed within, enveloping his sleep, becoming one with his breath, penetrating the chambers of his exploding heart. I was blessed with a vision of his last moments, rising from the smoke of cherished mementos of the Continental Drift Club. An enthusiasm pulsed through me whose language I knew well. "These are modern times," I told myself, "but we are not trapped in them. We can go where we like, communing with angels, to reprise a time in human history more science fiction than the future." I have smoothed the hem of the robe of Parsifal, watched Giotto's sheep wander from a fresco, prayed before holy icons unveiled, surviving time, held shavings swept from the hut of Geppetto, unzipped a body bag and beheld the face of my brother, witnessed the accolade, scatter petals over a dying poet. I saw the smoke of incense form the shape of my days. I saw my love return to God. I saw things as they are. Shard by shard, we are released from the tyranny of so-called time. A curtain of purple wisteria partially conceals the entrance to a familiar garden. I take my seat at an oval table, Sheeler's portal, and reach across to caress the wrist of the sad-eyed mathematician. The separating chasm closes. In a wink, a lifetime, we pass through the infinite movements of a silent overture. A light-hearted procession moves through the halls of an illustrious institution. Joseph Kinect,
Evariste Gawa, members of the Vienna Circle. I watch him as he rises, following at their heels, whistling softly. The long vines sway ever so slightly. I picture Alfred Wegener and his wife Elsie having tea in a drawing room flooded with light, and then I begin to write. Not of science, but of the human heart. I write fervently, as a student at her desk, bowed over her composition book, composing not as she is bid, but as she desires.
Road to La Roche.
On April Fool's Day, I reluctantly prepared for yet another journey.
I was invited to participate in a conference of poets and musicians in Tangier to honor the beat writers who had once made it their port of call. I much preferred to be in Rockaway Beach, drinking coffee with the workers and watching the slow but meaningful process of the salvation of my little house. On the other hand, I would be joining good friends, and April